Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Good morning and welcome to We the People, the Constitution Matters on 1180 WFYL. Mike Levins here. Joining me every time, every week, is Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative in Yorktown, Virginia. And we also have a special guest with us this morning as well. We have Dr. Max Lyons, Director of Teaching Services for the Foundation for American Christian Education. Phil and David will not be joining us this morning, but we are very pleased to have Dr. Max Lyons with us this morning. Dr. Max, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Mike. I'm glad to be here.
It's wonderful to have you here. As we're going to start our discussion, we've been talking about the Founders' worldview in past weeks. We are moving now into their worldview on religion, of all things. And this is probably the most crucial, I would think, Gary.
Well, it is, because if we're going to say that the founders had a biblical worldview, then that would suggest that the Bible, and therefore religion in general, would undergird their worldview as it regards every other subject. So this is kind of the centerpiece. Even though we've covered it fourth in the sequence, we've done so because of the Peirce construct. P-E-E-R-S stands for political, economic, educational, religion, and social. So we've covered it forth in sequence, but really it is the centerpiece of a biblical worldview.
And if we don't have that, then we lose a lot of the founders' other worldviews that they had, and it touches everything. So we are talking about the cornerstone this morning of their worldviews being religion. And Dr. Max, you excited to jump in?
Absolutely, yes. I'm just thinking on this introductory part here, you know, the idea of America being a Christian nation, you know, what does that mean? That's kind of has and always been a hot topic, and some would argue yes, and some would argue no, and some would argue something in between. But drilling down into the worldview and the religion of the founders really helps to bring some clarity upon that issue.
Well, like we said, this is the cornerstone of them all. If we could understand this, because we know how religion is a cornerstone, at least personally in our lives, and it was the same way for the founders, especially in that day and time. Religion was the cornerstone of many aspects of society. So if we understand their worldview on religion, then we'll understand their worldviews touching every other part of their lives. So now I think the best place to start, at least for the sake of the discussion, would be with Thomas Jefferson, because he's probably the most famous of the founders for his views on religion. He's most famously been called a deist. Gary, your thoughts?
Well, he has. He's probably one of the founders, along with Ben Franklin, who are most routinely called deists, but I don't think either one of them was. Make sure that we understand what a deist was, and if we look at the the definition of deism, not only today, but I believe it was the definition that held in their time, it was of a an absentee God. That is, there was a God who created the universe, but once he was finished with that, he went on holiday and let things run pretty much as they do. There was a God that did not intervene in human affairs through miracles or supernatural revelation, as today's definition reads. Well, if that is your definition of deism, and the deists seem to think that that represents their definition, then neither Jefferson nor Franklin fit that definition, because they both acted as though they thought God, in fact, did continue to intervene in human affairs.
Well, and if they are if God is continuing to intervene in human affairs, then the impact of that in their and what they believe is going to be reflected. And on that, I actually want to read a quote from author Norman Cousins, which you included in an essay, weekly essay that you put out, Gary. We've talked about here in the program. We draw a lot from it when we have these discussions. But here's the quote: "The founders connected their spiritual beliefs to political action. They saw no walls separating science, philosophy, religion, and art." So with that quote, Dr. Max, what do you think of that?
Well, I just think I agree with that. We tend to, in our day, sometimes we tend to compartmentalize our lives. And it's very common today to compartmentalize the religious part of your life. As a matter of fact, they've done studies of the number of people that say or believe or act like whatever they do on Sunday morning. I'm talking about even church-going people. Whatever they do on Sunday morning has nothing to do with or does not connect with their lives, you know, Monday through Saturday. So, you know, this kind of disconnect in our thinking, although it's common today, I would say for the founders was not common. And all you have to do is do a little reading of their writings, and that's what most people don't do today. But do a little bit reading of their writings, and you'll see this theme kind of throughout. And on that note, I would just challenge people to actually look at primary sources in this regard. If you're going to look at the founders, you really shouldn't just look at historians and biographers and what they've said about them. You should actually take the time to read some of their actual writings. And this can be very, very enlightening. It's been a practice of mine for a number of decades now. And a good example of that would be Thomas Jefferson. And our colleague and friend Mark Belisles, who I hope could join us either today or at another time, has done exactly this. And he did this for his doctoral dissertation, which was on the religious views of Thomas Jefferson. And literally, the man has spent several decades of his life studying, reading and studying the writings of Jefferson, as well as, you know, his works, as well as what biographers have said and historians have said about him. And he contends that what historians and biographers generally do is go back and read and quote other historians and biographers, and that he has uncovered primary sources of Jefferson and brought them to out to the market that no one before him has. And so, you know, I would challenge people that, for instance, if you're interested in Thomas Jefferson's beliefs, to read Belisle's book, Doubting Thomas, The Religious Life and Legacy of Thomas Jefferson, because I've heard him lecture on this and read some of the book, not the entire book, but he uncovers things that I had never heard before in decades of study of Jefferson.
Well, and hopefully we'll have Mark Belisles joining us later in the program. You could join us in the program if you have a question for Dr. Max or Gary or even myself. That number, 610-539-TALK, 610-539-8255. Now, Mark, I had no idea that he wrote a dissertation on Thomas Jefferson. So I really hope he's able to join us later in the program to be able to talk about that. Well, I look forward to that if he is. If not, though, we are going to continue. We have plenty, indeed, to talk about regarding this topic. Now, in order to understand the religious worldview, and you know, before we actually go into that, I would like to make the point of today we like to try to understand things in how we understand things today, meaning we want a soundbite, we want it boiled down, and we want it fed to us in a way, and that's why we may look to a historian to kind of give us the summation of everything the founders were saying and then move on and kind of get a quick little study, when that's not how the founders operated. We can't try to understand the founders in a way that they wouldn't have tried to understand things by just trying to get a quick soundbite. They would have gone to the primary source and actually, like you had just talked about there, Mark, and actually look things up. I mean, I would think that that's what we have to do, Gary.
Well, we do, and that's why I come to the conclusion that I did, and which Dr. Belisle does in his book, that Jefferson was not a deist. If you look at his writings in totality, you just can't come away with that view. And I picked out one that, for me, is very compelling. In his Notes on Virginia, Jefferson talks about the slave trade, and he says, "Can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we've removed their only firm basis, a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are the gift of God, that they are not to be violated but with his wrath? Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever." So Jefferson is saying here that God's justice, God's sense of justice, is enraged by this slave trade, this iniquitous slave trade, as some would call it, and God is going to come down and inflict his judgment on the nation because of this. Well, that is not a deist God. That is clearly not a God who is absentee. It's a God who's quite aware of what's going on, and not only aware, enraged by what he sees and willing to interact with that creation in a way that, as Jefferson just suggests, is not going to be pleasant.
Well, and just to remind our listeners, the goal of doing all this to understand the founders' worldview on the program is so that we could better understand their writings and what they mean for us today, and what it means specifically with the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and how we govern our nation. By understanding the founders' worldviews on these different topics, we can understand their writings more and what they meant for us today. So that is the end goal when we're looking into all this, and there is value in looking into what the founders believed just on its own as well, and we're jumping right into it. So, Gary, kind of paint a picture. Let's begin here. Now, we've got to, in order to understand how the founders saw religion, we kind of have to understand the religious history of the time in which they lived.
Well, yes, and I'm sure Max will be able to jump in on this one, because he's done a lot of study at the Foundation for American Christian Education on just this topic. In fact, the Foundation produces a couple of great books on this topic, The Christian History of the American Revolution and The Christian History of the Constitution of the United States. They're both excellent references, and I strongly suggest people who are interested in this topic consider getting a copy. But look at this whole religious history of the founding period. As I say, it continues for over 169 years. From 1607 to 1776, that's like the same period of time as from today back to 1846. When you look at 1846, we think that is ancient history. Well, that's the time it took to found initially in Jamestown and then separate the colonies in 1776 from the mother country. So that's a long, long period of time. And over that period of time, we see Christians of various persuasions coming to America to settle, initially a mixed bag, but mostly Anglicans coming into Jamestown, and then the Pilgrims, the Separatists, as they call themselves, coming into Plymouth in 1620, and then 10 years later, a group of Puritans coming from England to New England in 1630. So a lot of different denominations start making their way to America, and by the time of the 1830s, when Alexis de Tocqueville takes an assessment of this situation, he finds that the number of sects or denominations was innumerable. So today I think we have 400 and some Christian denominations. They certainly had many by the time of de Tocqueville's inventory.
That number just floors me. Over 400 different denominations. Now, it's worthy to note as well that a lot of those immigrants came from a nation where the Christian church was the official, and as you say in your essay, the state-supported religion. That's important to note as well, because basically, again, it's a state-supported religion. Christianity was the very fact of these people. So that's going to, when they're coming with that influence over to America at the time, then they're going to, I guess, expect that in some way when they actually immigrate to America, whether they're trying to or not. I mean, Dr. Max, what do you think?
Well, I would just, you know, there's a lot of different ways you can go with this, but I like to go all the way back to the beginning, and you know, because that really sets the tone for our nation in terms of its religious history, and you know, you're really opening it up. You know, there are some very good books on the subject, and as Gary noted, the Foundation for American Christian Education publishes some of these, primarily in the form of republishing primary sources, so that people can go back and actually read the writings for themselves, rather than just, you know, again, trust a historian, even if it's somebody that you know and trust. So, you know, if you go all the way back to the beginning, with the, you know, Gary mentioned the Jamestown settlers and the Pilgrims, and of course, you know, Jamestown was 1607 and Plymouth was 1620. But if you go back to the Jamestown settlement, for instance, you know, a lot of people will say that was a secular founding versus the Pilgrims, which was actually a congregation. But if you go back into the if you want to sell the question of whether the Jamestown settlement was secular or Christian, again, go back into their documents. There was a series of charters that were written starting at 1606. And when you go back into those charters, you'll find that it's clearly stated that propagating the gospel to those that lived in this land, the Native Americans, was one of their purposes. That was stated over and over and over again. So that kind of, you know, and whether to the extent that was successful or done, you know, could be discussed and debated, but that certainly was the original vision of Richard Hakluyt and others, who were the ones that envisioned this settlement. And then if you go to the Pilgrims, you know, we have an authoritative source in William Bradford, who's the governor of the Pilgrims for a couple of decades. We have an authoritative source in his journal, which was actually the first piece of literature, English literature, written upon these shores. And Bradford says at one point in his history of the Pilgrims, he said, "Last and not least, a great hope and inward zeal they had of laying some good foundation, or at least to make some way thereunto, for the propagating and advancing the gospel of the kingdom of Christ in those remote parts of the world, yea, though they should be even as stepping stones unto others for the performing of so great a work." So they clearly stated that the propagation of the gospel was you know, one of their main purposes. And the Pilgrims, we know another very important reason that they came is that, you know, they had left England and had fled because of religious persecution, and were living in Holland for 11 years before they came to America. And what was happening there is their children were being drawn away into by the evil culture there in Holland, and by many temptations, and they were very vexed by that. Being a Christian, a very solid Christian people and a Christian congregation, they hated the fact that their children were being tempted away from from their relationship with Christ. So that's another reason they came, was to build a Christian civilization where they could raise their children without these temptations, and ultimately to design and build a Christian nation. That was their intent. You know, whether you agree with that or not, that's the historical record.
And that's what happens when you have all these different pilgrims come over. When you have the Jamestown settlement as well, you're looking at the makings of a Christian foundation. And you know, Christian nation, that term has been thrown around a lot of late, but history certainly shows us that the foundation was there for Christian nation, that in fact the land was full of Christians, Gary.
It was. Up and down the seaboard, you had, by the time of the first census, I think it was 3 million Americans in the first census, and, I'll throw out a statistic here, because about 84% of statistics are made up on the spot. But
that's a good one.
But I'd say that it's certainly well over 90% of Americans in the first census were Christians, and there's just no getting around that. And Christianity had been the basis for the legal system. The Fundamental Orders of Connecticut basically is come out blatantly and say that until you get around to enacting more elaborate laws, rule based on the Word of God. And so, how blatant can you be? This Christian legal system that they were setting up in Connecticut was to be based on the Word of God until such time as they could build upon that. So, Christian nation, yes, it certainly was, but today that term takes on a different meaning, and people get offended when you even suggest that we were at one time a Christian nation, because today the Christian religion doesn't have the sway that it once had over all of culture. And so back in the colonial times, it's really hard to put yourself into that mindset, but Christianity was everything. It was the legal system, it was the social system, it was the religious system, it was the educational system, it was the economic system, it was everything.
Well, to read a quote from Noah Webster, he says, quote, "In my view, the Christian religion is the most important and one of the first things in which all children under a free government ought to be instructed. No truth is more evident to my mind than that the Christian religion must be the basis of any government intended to secure the rights and privileges of a free people." Very provocative statement that would be today, but that was probably encouraged and even applauded in his time.
Well, yes, and it was one of the few things that the founders completely agreed upon, was this connection between religion and morality that formed it, and the success of Republican government. They all agreed that there had to be religion and morality in the people, producing a virtue, a Christian virtue, and that was an absolutely essential ingredient for free government, for religion, for Republican government. That if you look at their writings, that is the one theme that comes through from many, many of the founders.
Well, we've got to head to a break. We're going to be getting into that in the next segment. We've touched a little bit on the history, at least the very founding of our nation. There's much more in between that and the founders, but we're going to jump into the founders' specific looks on religion in the next segment of the program. You can call again at 610-539-TALK, 610-539-8255. Topic today, founders' worldviews on religion. What that means, for the Constitution, everything that we understand in our country, how it operates. We have Dr. Max Lyons joining us as a special guest, who's Director of Teaching Services for the Foundation for American Christian Education. We'll be back after this.
This is a Fox News alert. I'm Chris Foster. A terrorist attack in southeastern France. President Francois Hollande says one person is dead, two hurt, with one arrest. It happened at a gas factory.
A car driven by one individual, maybe with another one, another individual, and they crashed into the building.
Fox's Greg Palcott says the person killed was beheaded.
The head of the man was put on a fence nearby, and Arabic slogans were affixed to it via some notes. Also, some gas canisters were exploded there at the scene. A fire ensued. That was put out.
The French Interior Ministry says suspected accomplices are in custody. The man who is suspected of doing this is known to French intelligence.
Hey, Grandma, can you help me with my Common Core lesson on the Constitution? But the only part we're reading in eighth grade is the preamble and the First Amendment. I wonder when we'll get to study the rest of it. Didn't you say our founding fathers were wise patriots and wrote the Constitution and the Bill of Rights to protect our freedom? This Common Core book we're reading says our founding fathers were racist and they didn't think women or blacks should ever be allowed to vote. She says, we the people, didn't really mean you and me, but some rich white guys. That just makes me feel terrible about our country. We need to change things.
Oh, honey, that's not true at all. Our country is the greatest country the world has ever seen, and our founding fathers worked hard to be fair to everyone. I'm going to call our school board and our state board of education and ask why they allow Common Core and this book in your school.
Call your representatives now and ask them to stop Common Core and restore local control. Pennsylvanians Against Common Core brought you this message. Go to nopacommoncore.com or call 484-678-2236.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
Good morning and welcome to We the People, the Constitution Matters. Mike Levins here along with Gary Porter, who's Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative in Yorktown, Virginia. And a special guest today, we have Dr. Max Lyons joining us, who's Director of Teaching Services for the Foundation of American Christian Education. And you know, I didn't even ask you this before, but may I call you Dr. Max?
Certainly. That works.
Dr. Lyons just sounds a little too formal for this morning. I'll just stick with Dr. Max. You told me that you're talking a little bit on the break. You said that you get that a lot.
Yes.
Dr. Max. All right, well, there's a quote that I read on the prior segment here, and I'll read it again. It was by Noah Webster. We're talking about the founders' worldviews on religion, and then the end goal being, well, what does that mean for the different writings that they had? The Constitution, Declaration of Independence, going into our nation. Are we a Christian nation or not? All those topics are free game this morning as we talk about the founders' worldview on religion. You could call in at 610-539-TALK, 610-539-8255 for either a question for me, Gary Porter, or for Dr. Max Lyons. And here's the quote that I read, and I'll read it again. In my view, the Christian religion is the most important and one of the first things in which all children under a free government ought to be instructed. No truth is more evident to my mind than that the Christian religion must be the basis of any government intended to secure the rights and privileges of a free people. That was from Noah Webster. Now, Dr. Max, you had some thoughts on that.
Well, it's not a very, in today's climate, it's not a very politically correct statement to say
no,
that Christianity ought to be taught and Christianity ought to be the basis of our governments. But again, it's indicative of the thinking of the founders. And their view of education is very interesting, and I've studied it for many years, being an educator, lifetime educator. But Noah Webster himself he wrote, you know, we all think of Webster, we think of Webster's Dictionary. Well, our foundation actually produces, reprints the original dictionary, original Webster's Dictionary, which was published in 1828. And one reason why we think it's very important to keep that in print is because Webster, being a Christian, used the Bible as the basis for the meaning of words. He also researched every word and in the 26 languages that came into a part of our language, researched every word back to its original language, so it was extremely accurate. But Webster himself, although raised in the church and as a Christian, didn't come to Christ until later in his life, in his 50s, but had a very dramatic conversion. But the one thing I want to say about the educators, the founders' view of education, is you would think that this is evidence of America as a Christian nation. You would think that if we were a Christian people, that we would take the education of our children in a Christian way very seriously. And indeed, we did. The first college in this country was of course Harvard. But a lot of people don't know that Harvard was first established as a seminary. The Pilgrims and the Puritans wanted to make sure that they had learned ministers. When our ministers, current ministers, lie in the dust, who's going to teach us the Word of God? So Harvard was established as a Christian seminary. But in terms of Christian education, if you look at the history of this nation, we took education of our children in the scriptures very, very seriously, to the extent that for over 200 years, from 1607 to roughly 1830, education in this country was private. First of all, it was private. It was not public or government. There were a few experiments with this, but they mostly failed. And they were mostly in New England and in Massachusetts. But most people point to that as the beginnings of government education, but most people don't point to the fact that they failed and they were in a competitive market. People chose private education. But anyway, education from 1607 to 1830 was private, and it was for the most part Christian, operated in homes and in churches. Often the teacher, the pastor, was often the teacher in the school as well, at least on a part-time basis. So this is pretty strong evidence of a Christian nation, a Christian people giving their children a Christian education over 200 years.
And that's got a lot of weight for you, Dr. Max. You know, you're Director of Teaching Services for the Foundation of, or the Foundation for American Christian Education, so that has a lot of weight for you. Now, I want to read And that's a good thing, by the way. I want to read the religious affiliation. This is a compilation of 175 founding fathers. Here are their religious affiliations, according to percentage. 50.2% were Episcopalian or Anglican, which makes sense because a lot of them would have been from England, which that was the state religion of England at the time. Presbyterian comes in at 17.1%. 15.4% were Congregationalist, 4.4% were Quaker, 2.8% were Dutch Reformed or German Reformed, 2.8% were Lutheran, 1.7% Catholic, 1.7% Huguenot, another 1.7% come in at Unitarian, 1.1% at Methodist, and 0.6% Calvinist. Those are all Christian denominations, for the most part, that I see coming in there. And that's 175 of the founding fathers. So that kind of paints a picture as we're going to be delving into topics now, what their religious affiliations were. Let's go ahead now. They all came from states where church and state were not separated. Let's look at their views on the relationship of church and state. Gary, why don't you start us off for this one?
Well, yes, you mentioned church and state were not separated. At least 9 of the 13 colonies established official state religions. Virginia, here, the Anglican Church was officially established as a state religion. I don't want to go down through the whole list, but almost all the states, and you can see that in their state constitutions. I say in the essay, you know, if you really want to understand this separation of church and state issue, the best place to start is by reading the 13 original state constitutions. That's going to give you the flavor of what they thought the separation should consist of, if anything. And 5 of the states granted specific privileges to certain denominations of the Christian religion. And those 5, in fact, their status as official religions endured past the ratification of the Constitution. So the First Amendment didn't come along until 1791, but even the First Amendment didn't change that dichotomy, that there at the state level, there was no problem with a state religion and an official religion. So we think that the Constitution established the separation between church and state. Well, it did at the national level. The First Amendment was clearly in Madison's original draft and clearly intended to keep from there being a national religion. But at the state level, there was no problem with that, and Madison and the others who were drafting this First Amendment didn't see any reason why states couldn't have state religions.
And if we're looking at the relationship between states and the Constitution, where it may have been prohibited at the national level, we want to take that to a contemporary issue. The Supreme Court coming out yesterday in support of Obamacare in their ruling, which basically stated that the states that had not set up exchanges were still going to be getting federal funding, even though they might have not set up those exchanges for health care, because to avoid the federal subsidies for whatever reason. You want to talk about states' rights. The Supreme Court came out in support of a federal law over the states' rights to choose, and you want to talk about this difference in state-sponsored religion, so to speak, you could say, where the states are making them there, at least historically, they're, because you make the point, like you just did, that in your essay, that the Constitution that may be prohibitive, but the state constitutions, the people who drafted those, they did not have any inhibition.
No, none whatsoever. And next week, when we finish up this series on the Founders' Worldview, after that, we'll get right back into taking a look at what the Supreme Court is doing in some of their most recent rulings. So I'm anxious to to get this over with and back into looking at the court.
You've been digging through a lot of documents, haven't you, Gary?
Well, I have, and it's been fun, and it's really been a great series. But there's also things we need to talk about, like what the court did yesterday in their announcement on King versus Burwell, and essentially rewriting the law that Congress didn't write very well. The court went and rewrote it the way the court thought it should have been reflected. So
right.
we'll get into that in a couple more weeks. But for right now, this issue of church and state is still very important to us today. We debate this all the time. But to the founders, they didn't see it quite the way we do today. And they didn't, even though they may have had a problem with a national church that would have preempted all of the state churches, they had no problem with the state churches. And well, okay, you could argue that Jefferson and Madison had a problem with the Anglican Church being established in Virginia, and that's what produced their statute for religious freedom that they were so proud of. But still, the intermingling of church and state was not a big problem for them.
Dr. Max, I'd like to
hear
your thoughts.
I would say that, just reflecting upon this, it took a while for us as a nation to get this church state, or, you know, and you could take it really, church state and Christianity state are two different things. But it took them a while to get this right, because they all came out of a history where there was an established religion, and usually an established Protestant religion. But there are certainly problems with an official established religion in being recognized and encouraged by, or mandated by the government. And I would not be an advocate out of that. I would be, you know, I would agree with the founders in that there should be a separation of the institution of the church and the institution of the state, but not a separation of Christianity and government, which it is what it has become today. So we don't want to be misunderstood as advocating, for instance,
a state religion, so to speak.
A state religion. Well, in today's time, just look at Islam. You know, there's no concept of the separation of the institution of Islam and of the government, and that is once they take over a nation, then they want to establish Sharia law as the law of the land, and our founders would have shuddered at such a thing, and we should today. So we want Christianity in all of our institutions, our government, in our media, in our schools, but we don't want the institutions of the church and state to be joined.
And John Jay had a wonderful view of this. Our first Chief Justice after the Constitution was ratified, and he said that no human society has ever been able to maintain both order and freedom, both cohesiveness and liberty, apart from the moral precepts of the Christian religion. Should our republic ever forget this fundamental precept of governance, we will then be surely doomed. So he's not saying that we need an official Christian religion established as a state religion, but what we do need is the precepts of the Christian religion infused in the society. To the extent that we start putting that aside, then we place in peril our whole system of government.
Well,
that's what he's saying.
And you could even look at as well, let's look at a biblical example. You could look at what the Pharisees did in the time before Jesus came and after the last writings of the prophets. It's called the 400 years of silence there. You could look at what the Pharisees and the Sadducees did in basically creating a religious society, and we could do that same thing. Let's say we create a Christian state. Eventually, though, that too will fail. What is more important is that it is adopted, and I say this in other programs, you could legislate people to death, and eventually they will rebel. It's just human nature. What really needs to happen is people's hearts and minds need to be changed, and that's really the more important thing. That's what makes us a Christian nation, so to speak. That's why we had the First Great Awakening, the Second Great Awakening, which were both revivals that were by Jonathan Edwards and then Charles Wesley. So that's really the important thing. You could sit there and say we're a Christian state religion. You may have different views on that, but even at the end of the day, just saying that won't fix the issue. It's really a change in the hearts and minds of the culture of our nation as we know it. Now, let's get into the First Amendment. Now, the First Amendment, you know, James Madison's original wording of the amendment read like this: "The civil rights of none shall be abridged on account of religious belief or worship, nor shall any national religion be established, nor shall the full and equal rights of conscience be in any manner or on any pretext infringed." Now, when the amendment came out of the House Select Committee, it read like this: "No religion shall be established by law, nor shall the equal rights of conscience be infringed." And then finally, so we're seeing three stages here of the First Amendment: "Congress shall make no law establishing articles of faith or a mode of worship or prohibiting the free exercise of religion." And then after that, it comes into what we know it today. Gary, what do you think of that metamorphosis?
Well, yes, you can certainly see that they changed their view as it went from the House to the Senate and back to the House Conference Committee. Different aspects of it got added, but I focused on the original, and what Madison was trying to achieve there was to prevent a national religion, but also to secure protection for the right of conscience. Now, we see that under attack today. Christians who are running their businesses and trying to run their businesses in accordance with Christian precepts are under attack when they try to run those businesses the way they see fit. And so if a Christian baker doesn't want to participate in a homosexual marriage that he doesn't agree with from a biblical perspective, well, he's being attacked for that view, and that's certainly not what James Madison would have preferred.
No, most certainly not. And also, when we're talking about the establishment of a state religion, or would that have been the founders' views? It would not have been, probably, most likely, we could agree, the founders' view. You also do have to think, though, what laws would be inherently Christian by nature, and even argue that laws in and of themselves are inherently Christian in nature. We have laws today, but not many of them are being followed, it would seem, and that certainly is not because of Christian influence. It's because of the lack thereof, a lot of people would argue, because the rule of law would be disintegrating. Christian influence does actually give you the rule of law. And you also, even scripturally, when we're talking about Christian influence, you could also look at the Israelites and how Israel was governed. And you could even look at that being a quote-unquote Christian-governed nation, because they're very much religiously governed. So there's a lot of spiritual implications there as well for Christian if we're talking about that. But let's go now into the founders' other religious views. There's some other things that they believed as well there. Gary, go ahead.
Well, let me tack on to what you just said. Every law is religious in the sense that it takes a moral position. There is a right and a wrong behavior that every law describes. So every law is moral in the sense in that sense. But then getting to the other views, yes, the founders, as you said very at the beginning, saw religion as seamless, that their religion informed every part of their life. So as they faced important questions such as capital punishment or whether war is just, they first and foremost took their view from the Bible as they informed themselves on those issues. But even then, they came away sometimes with different views. Take capital punishment. We today have a national dialogue on whether capital punishment is right or not. and people in the religious community certainly have taken different views of that as well. But Jefferson thought it was perfectly normal and justifiable that death might be inflicted for murder or perhaps for treason, as he says. But then Benjamin Rush looks to the Bible and comes away with that the punishment of murder by death is contrary to divine revelation. A religion which commands us to forgive and even to do good to our enemies can never authorize the punishment of murder by death. So even though they both looked to the Bible, they came away with a different view. Rush, I think, was inaccurately describing what is a personal and individual reaction to evil, where we should personally turn the other cheek. I think that is Jesus's command to us, but that doesn't necessarily apply at a national level or at a governmental level. So Rush, I think, is incorrect in this view, but nevertheless, he came away from his search of Scripture with this other view of capital punishment.
Dr. Max?
Well, they certainly did have differing views on differing subjects. You know, a lot of times we talk about the founders as if they're, you know, their belief systems were homogeneous, and they were in many ways more so than now, because they did, many of them, embrace a solid biblical worldview. But even today, as they, you know, you talk among your Christian friends, and you'll find that, you know, you can have deep disagreements on issues of much importance. But I think that the takeaway on this is that what was, you know, what appeal, you know, we make appeals to different authorities. You know, today we appeal to the founders, and that's why we're talking about them. But an appeal to Scripture is something that Christians do all the time. You know, we say the Bible teaches this, or the Bible teaches that, or the Bible doesn't teach this or that. And the fact that they recognized Scripture as authoritative and appealed to it, it used to be, you know, there was a day that on the House of the Senate or the House of the Representatives, someone can get up and say, this is what the Scriptures say, and everybody's ears would perk up, and that would be very, very important, because they were bringing forth what God had said on that subject. You know, we don't live in that society today, but the founders, that was very normal for them to consult the Scriptures.
And the founders were used to living in that environment. In every aspect of their lives, Christianity was found, whether it was in their individual states as a state religion, or whether it was just in their own personal faith, going to church on Sunday.
Yeah.
Or whether it was in their culture. It was everywhere, absolutely everywhere, and it influenced absolutely everything that they did. I think that's undeniable.
I wanted to go back to the chart that you had read of the religious affiliation. I just wanted to clarify one thing there. Most of them were part of Protestant denominations, but obviously Catholicism was, you know, that's different from Protestantism. That was 1.7%. And then Unitarian. Although Unitarian was not, the Unitarian of that day was not the same as the Unitarian of today, which today Unitarian is just totally pagan. It's not Christian. They don't believe the Bible at all. In the time of our founders, it was not quite like that, and Mark Bilal brings that out in his book.
Well, and that's important to note. We're wrapping up the program here today. Thank you so much for listening. Dr. Max, thank you for coming on today. It was a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you.
Well, that's the Constitution, We the People, here on 1180 WFYL. Thank you so much for listening. Mike Levins, Gary Porter, and Dr. Max Lyon saying thank you, and we'll see you next week. Same time, same place, 7 to 8. We're going to be talking about the Supreme Court. Don't miss it.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate, Senior citizens mention WFIL, receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.